Chapter 10, College. I'm not going to go into all the particulars of college. You know, those things are, so many things happen, so many dumb things. But I'd like to lay down a few things here. For one, when I got back from that hitchhiking trip with Dick Carr and got home on South Lake Irving in Bemidji, Dad said he wanted to see me the next day in his office. So I showed up. He picked up the phone, made a call, hung up and said, "You're in at Carleton College and you leave in 2 weeks." So I always figure like I got shanghaied to Carleton. And once I got there, and Dad's demeanor towards me totally changed. Instead of being a kid, I was a boy, a man. And but when I got to Carleton, I wasn't there very long. I found out how overmatched I was. That was one tough school. So I managed to find a lot of time down in the local place called Friggy Wells Emporium. There was one bar down there would serve college kids. It was jam-packed all the time, and you could hardly wake your way through there. So I went out the alley one time and saw this other place up the street. Went in there, and it was dead in there, a big bar, and it was really dead. And I asked him for a beer, and they gave it to me without checking my age. So I spread the word around. Next thing you know, we made that Friggy Wells Emporium a place to go. One time, this is Friggy. There's four of us sitting in a booth, and Friggy said, "I tell you what, you guys, I'll lock you in the beer cooler for an hour, and if you can last that hour, everything you drink is on me. And if you don't last an hour, you have to pay for your drink, for your beer." So a hell of a deal. We went in there. I guess we weren't allowed to wear our winter jackets or anything, but we were still pretty warmly dressed. We get in there, he closes the locker. He turned that cooler all the way down. But it didn't seem to bother us too much because we had all that free beer. However, there was no place to relieve yourself except in a corner of the cooler. And after an hour, Friggy let us out, you know, and he saw what a mess it was there, and he says, "That's the dumbest thing I ever did in my life." But he was a real good guy. His brother was the chief of police, and his brother would tell him when there's going to be a raid. So Friggy would say, "Okay, you guys, you can't come around for about 3 days," and then we'd come back. Met a lot of people, of course, in college, but one or two really stick out. A kid named Skip Johnson, he lived across the hall from me when I was a sophomore, and we used to play a lot of cards, a lot of whist. Skip had a little tick. He'd be dealing the cards or looking at his cards, and all of a sudden his one hand would shoot in the air with the finger pointing upward. You know, for a while you start looking up to see what he's doing, but it's just a tick. And, you know, somehow I managed to pass all those draft deferment tests, but Skip didn't. He flunked out. And the last I heard, we heard about Skip, it was during the Korean War, and he died, burned to death in a tank in Korea. Really, really sad story. There was a time in there, of course, where panty raids were popular. I never went on them. I remember there was a big raid one time, and I was just sitting on a ledge outside of our second story dorm room, and Dean Jarko, he and I didn't get along too well anyway, he spotted me up on that ledge and says, "Hey, Butler, I thought you'd be leading the pack." I told him, "No, hey, it's amateur night." So, I got in a lot of trouble one time. I got overserved down at Friggy's and came back up. I don't know what got into me, but I had a whole bunch of old records, real old records. When mom and dad bought the radio station, they of course had a real library of old records. And I went through there and I pulled out some of them and took them to college with me. Anyway, I went in and got a whole bunch of those records. We're talking about, you know, the old 78s, hard plastic discs. And I sailed them down this long hallway in the freshman sophomore dorm. And I remember one even sailed down and stuck in a door jamb down there. But I made a big mess in there. Then I disappeared back to Friggy's Wells for about 2 or 3 days, and somebody came in and told me, he says, hey, Dean Jarko is really looking for you. So, of course, eventually I had to go see the dean. He says, you're out of here. He said, I'll let you know when you can get back in. Remember, I called Mom and said, Mama, I've been tossed out for a while. And she didn't really get into it too much. She just said, how are you going to get home? I said, hitchhike, I guess. And that may have been that hitchhiking deal where I ended up with those awful drunks in Cass Lake. Anyway, I went to work in the station. I wrote a little copy and stuff like that, and I got the mail. That was one of my chores. I went down about 10 days later and got the mail, and there was a letter in there to him from Dean Jarko. So I opened it up, and it said, Jarko says, Roger can come back on such and such a date, but you really ought to talk to him about his alcohol consumption. So I tore up that whole letter, came back to the radio station. I told Mom, I said, Jarko said I can come back, and she never asked me to see the letter, which I'm glad. After a couple of years at Carlton, I was going with a girl by a very nice young lady by the name of Joan Stevens. Joan decided to transfer to university, and I thought that was a heck of a good idea. So she got accepted, but I got a turndown letter. I remember my grades weren't good enough to go from Carlton to the University of Minnesota. So once in a while, Dad came to the rescue. He called some assistant dean down there, talked to him, and he says, well, we got to go down to the Twin Cities and see him in person. So we went down and saw some female assistant dean, and after some conversation, she said, well, we've had pretty good luck with people from Carlton College. He says, we'll let you in, but you're on academic probation. So I lucked out that first quarter. I was there in the class. I had a heck of a time deciding what I wanted to do, you know, and you had to declare your major for your junior year. So I picked sociology for some reason, and then I ended up taking a required course in social statistics. And when it came to the final exam, it was an open book deal, and this professor would go around and he'd correct you if you were wrong, so how can you not miss getting an A? And it had a lab with it, so it was 5 credits of A. So I whistled. Right off of that academic probation, and then I was able to pledge a fraternity. Well, when I got there for orientation week, before this all started, I was out in the mall, that big huge section between all the classes down there, I don't know what they call it, quadrangle in some places, and I heard somebody yell my name, and I looked over across there, and there was Jerry Kelly, a kid I knew from Bemidji, mostly from out at the country club. I knew he was a rich kid from Devil's Lake, and the parents had a summer home there in Bemidji. And anyway, I went over and said hi, and he says, do you belong here? I told him I was just transferring. He says, you join any fraternity? And I said, no. He says, come with me. So he took me over to the ATO house and had lunch with everybody there and met him, and next thing I know, I'm what they call a pocket pledge. Because of my academic standing, I couldn't really pledge, but he gave me a ATO fraternity pin, and I put that in my pocket. So that's how I ended up at ATO. And there's a lot of stories about ATO, one of which was I became the social chairman in the senior year, and the kickoff party every fall is called a shipwreck party. So I had a roommate and assistant party chairman named Don Shawning, and Don and I were trying to figure out what the heck we can do to pep up the decorations for this shipwreck party, when I said, well, how about we climb the fence over the tennis courts and cut down a couple of those tennis nets. And Donnie thought that was a hell of a good idea. So there we are out at night, and we scrambled up and down over those high chain link fences and cut down a couple of those nets and took them down into the basement of the ATO and hit them. And boy, there was a big stink. The Daily newspaper came out with, they're really looking for a couple of culprits or whoever stole those nets. But nobody ever caught on, and we managed to turn those nets into very similar to fishing nets on hanging on the walls of our shipwreck party. This young lady I met at Carleton, Joan Stevens, and I got engaged in spring of our senior year. She's originally from Washington, D.C., and was planning on going back there. Mom and Dad talked to a congresswoman in northern Minnesota named Koya Knutson, and asked her if there's any way she could put me on her payroll there at in D.C. And she said, yeah. So I had a job, I thought. So after going through graduation exercise, in which I did not graduate, I was a little short on my credits and my major. I ended up in D.C. on Capitol Hill, and I walk in June of 1955, and I walk in to see the congressman. She's not there, and her administrative assistant takes me aside, and he said, look, we got a problem. We don't really have enough payroll money to put you on here, but the congresswoman has gotten some patronage for you in the House Post Office. So he says, how will that work for you? And I said, well, you know, there I was with maybe $100 or $200, and I got to do something. So I said, yeah, okay. So I don't know if I'm going to be there 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months, but I ended up being there 5 years. I have to back up here for a minute. There's a couple of college stories that I meant to say and tell, and I forgot about them. One involved, or a couple of them involved Jerry Kelly. He was a rich kid from Devil's Lake, that kind of kids that I normally disliked all that. But he was something special. Kelly was very unusual. In the paternity house in a great room one day, he looks at me and he says, let's have a crying contest. I said, what do you mean? We'll just stare at each other, see who cries first. So I stared at him, he stared at me, and next thing I know, he's got a tear running down his cheek. One of the favorite things I liked about him was the unusual things he did. We were sitting over in a beer joint, with those tall glasses of beer, and smoking cigarettes, and all of a sudden he takes the cigarette out of his mouth and holds it between his thumb and forefinger. That is, the lit end is against his forefinger and the unlit end is against his thumb. And then he just stares at me for a few seconds. Then finally, calmly just takes that cigarette out and takes another puff on it. I said, how the hell do you do that, Kelly? Yeah, he says, it's simple. He says, you know, you got your hand on this wet, cold beer glass. You just take it off to put the cigarette between those wet, cold fingers, and says, for a few seconds, you won't feel the burn. I tried it a few times, you know, it works. I haven't done it in years, though. And in fact, I haven't smoked in 40 years, so that'd be the last chance I had would have been 40 years ago. Another story was about Skip. Skippy, we lived in a section of the dormitory that was for sophomores and juniors. And Skip got in an argument with a junior one day about nothing in particular, but he was so sure about that he was right. And this guy was kind of a jerk, that he was a loudmouth jerk he was talking to. So he told him, I tell you what, I'll bet you, I'll kiss your ass if I'm wrong. Well, son of a gun, old Skippy was wrong. And then they set the time and date. A room across the hall, a bigger room, so more people could crowd in there. And the witching hour approached, and this jerky junior, he came in there, and he got up on a table, and he dropped his pants, and he had on a pair of tidy whities with a big circle cut out of one cheek on his underwear. And we waited, and Skippy was pretty prompt. He showed up. Boy, he didn't look like he really wanted to do this. But he worked his way through the crowd, got over the table, and gave this guy a little peck on his butt. Yeah, that brought down the house, you know. That took a lot to do. And I think everybody in that room admired Skippy for his courage. Kelly and I had he had a room in which there was a dual studying space. So it was one bed and two places to study. So I ended up being his study buddy, so to speak. All I can remember that we did was he had a huge wicker bottle of Chianti wine. I remember that's all we did there, sit there drinking wine. We had this jerky New York Proctor across the hall that everybody hated. In fact, he had exotic fish in there, and somebody went and shaved some soap into the fish tank and killed every damn one of them. And that was in my junior year. Luckily, in our senior year, we got a heck of a lot better guy. He's a fraternity brother, but he's from the South, Alabama, I think. And he just sat up. We had one little kind of a loft way up at the top of the chapter house, and he just hid up in there. Never saw him. He was studying to be a dentist. Don Lawler, I think, was his name. Anyway, with Kelly, I had a lot of my clothes in there, and one day to go into his room, and most of my clothes are missing, and a lot of his clothes are missing. So he said, well, I guess you have to call, have to get insurance information. You got insurance, don't you? And I said, well, I suppose my folks do. Anyway, I went downtown with him. Well, he bought a whole bunch of clothes at a real fancy men's shop. You know, it was Mr. Kelly this and Mr. Kelly that, the second floor of a building down in Minneapolis. Very fancy place. I went someplace else and got a charcoal gray suit, a pink shirt with French cuffs, and I don't know if you call that an Eton collar. And anyway, you put a pin through the collar, that was really spiffy dressing in those days. And years later, I got to thinking about it. I said, you know, I think Kelly took those clothes and threw them out, because he never did like the clothes I wore before we were robbed.